Every dollar we invested to map the human genome returned $140 to our economy. Every dollar. Today, our scientists are mapping the human brain to unlock the answers to Alzheimer's. They're developing drugs to regenerate damaged organs, devising new materials to make batteries 10 times more powerful. Now is not the time to gut these job-creating investments in science and innovation. Now is the time to reach a level of research and development not seen since the height of the space race. We need to make those investments.
President Obama on the compelling arguments for science and wealth creation. He said that if your plane is hitting turbulence and facing danger and you need to lose weight, you don't throw out the engine. Well, another president, the president of AAAS, is Professor Bill Press, an amazingly accomplished man who's been both professor of astronomy at Harvard and now professor of computer science and integrative biology at the University of Texas in Austin. What does he think of Barack Obama's State of the Union message?
Very positively. I thought the president recognizes that many, if not most, of the public policy issues facing us today have a very strong science component. For example, climate. For example, energy, energy independence. And the president took the position that we have to view science as an investment, not as simply an expenditure. One of the things the president said is, now is not the time to gut job-creating investments in science and innovation. Now is the time to reach a level of research and development that we haven't seen since the height of the space race. Well, in America right now, we're facing the reality that we're going to have a period of great austerity. And science could suffer greatly if it's simply cut along with other things that are going to be cut. So it's important that scientists make their best case that science is, as I believe, the greatest single engine ever invented by the human species for building jobs, building industries, building economies.
Is that generally recognized, do you think, in the community?
I think it's a mixture. It's certainly not a polarizing issue in the U.S. between right and left. I think there are supporters of science on both sides of that aisle. It's a question of what are you going to cut? Are you going to cut social benefits that are very real and make a big difference to people? It's a question between causing pain now or causing, we would say, even greater pain later down the road when you haven't made the investments, when your economy may be shrinking or not growing because you didn't keep making investments for the future.
I know there are some nations, I think famously Ireland, even though it had really terrible economic problems, did not cut science and found that the investment meant that that was the leader of their exports and in fact was making money for them.
Well, a figure that people keep their eyes on in the international scene is what fraction of a country's GDP, gross domestic product, does it spend in aggregate on research and development? And the United States is no longer first in the world. The United States is about seventh or eighth in the world, and I think third among developed economies after South Korea and Japan. If you look at a country like China, it's farther back in the pack, but it has a very steady growth trajectory. And it's clear that there's a danger that if in the United States we don't stick to the plan that science is a great investment and we start falling and other nations start growing, we're simply going to lose our competitive position in innovation.
Must be rather frustrating when you're talking about public money that you've got such a stop-start situation that you can't actually sign off on the budget like you can in most other countries and know it's there securely.
That's a very good point. And the United States spends just under 3% of its GDP on research and development. And I'm often asked, well, if you believe that it should be more, how much more should it be? And my answer is usually, it really should be only a little bit more, but it needs to be a lot more stable. We've had the situation in the U.S. in the last 5 years where in what we call ARRA, the Recovery Act, which was the stimulus money, a lot of stimulus money went to science, but it came 1 year and it went away a year and a half, 2 years later. And so it couldn't be used for things that really have a long-term benefit, like putting new graduate students into the training chain, which will lead to them contributing maybe 6, 8 years later as PhDs.
Now, when it comes to climate, there is a degree of skepticism in some quarters. from what the President was saying in his State of the Union address, do you think there is sufficient confidence in the problem being severe to take the line he has taken? You're speaking on behalf, of course, of the AAAS.
Well, I could be speaking on behalf of almost any scientist in the world. It's the overwhelming judgment of science. Those were the words that President Obama used, the overwhelming judgment of science that the Earth is getting hotter and that the most likely cause by far have been human interventions over the last century or so. So it's real and it's underway now. In the United States, just in the last few years, we've seen a visibly increased number of disasters. Large hurricanes, large storms, wildfires in the western United States have risen to unprecedented levels. I think ultimately what's going to convince the public is not some abstract set of measurements that the Earth is slowly growing warmer globally, which is true, but that as a consequence of that, more and more they're going to see real disasters or near misses occurring in their region. If they're on seacoasts, it's going to be storms. If they're in dry areas, it's going to be wildfires, and so on.
And innovation in that field would be also important, would it not?
Yeah. In fact, more generally, I think that in the past there's been a sense industry in some way is skeptical about climate change or is slow to accept it because it's going to upset their apple cart. Of course, any change provides opportunities for industry. You know, you can make money on good things and you can make money on bad things. And we're going to need industry to be looking at novel technical solutions in many of these areas of adaptation. What should we be doing when increasingly we're living in forests that are susceptible to wildfires, or when we have for 50 years been building houses along coastlines in areas that in the long run are probably not sustainable?
When it comes to your own work in computing, looking at the power of computing, do you see it simply continuing applied to genetics, the Human Genome Project, other genome projects, astronomy and so forth?
Well, my research now is in genomics. And in particular, what I and my students like to do is take the data of genomes that other people are rapidly sequencing and line them all up and see what evolution has done. And what's just tremendously fun about this, and also fundamental about it, is we're doing an experiment that life itself couldn't do. Because in the tree of life, if you have a division, a speciation, so that you have one species on one side and one species on the other side, their genomes never talk to each other again. They never get to go back and compare notes. Well, I evolved in this way and you evolved in the other way. Which of us is right? But we can do that now. We can line up the genomes and take a particular gene that has a particular function and say, oh, in this branch of the great tree of life, it went this way. In this other branch, it went this other way. Lining up that data mining, that finding very subtle effects in the genome, of course, is all large-scale computation.
And what can that be used for, do you think?
I think it shows not just where we happen to have evolved to, but it can be used to show what are the alternative choices that nature might have taken. And although evolution is very good at optimizing things, it's not perfect. So, for example, if we find that in the human genome there's an enzyme that has a particular function, but in other organisms it's done a little bit differently, that could be inspiring as to producing drugs for certain medical conditions, therapies, or simply understanding, ultimately, what are our genetic strengths and weaknesses.
It has been suggested that the analysis of tumors, cancers, to find out really what their own genome is like would then enable you to select more accurately the kind of therapies that might hit, not with a kind of 20% effectiveness, but an 80 or 85% effectiveness. Do you see that kind of approach being available in the near future?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, that's very close and is really already happening at a clinical trial level. In a certain sense, every cancer is a new organism. It's a piece of your body that has decided to disobey the rules that it was supposed to be programmed in and obey some new set of rules. So the fact that we're just at the point where every patient's tumor can be separately sequenced as if it was its own organism, and that that's going to be affordable, is going to allow us to treat each cancer as if it was its own, if you will, parasite on you, and find the therapies that are very specific to that.
You say it's affordable. Is it still not going to be reasonably expensive?
No, I think it's going to be almost trivial. We're at the level now where an entire human genome would cost, I haven't looked this week, but I think it's probably a few tens of thousands of dollars. People expect there to be $100 genomes within a very small number of years. That means a $100 test to give the full genetic sequence of a cancer tumor. I think this idea that your genome is some exotic thing that you'll never know is simply going to disappear. It'll be that as a small child, along with your vaccinations for things, you'll be sequenced, and forever after in your medical record will be your genetic sequence, and it will be used in all kinds of diagnostic and therapeutic ways.
Yeah, well, some people suggest there are about 10 different sorts of breast cancer in women, for example, and selecting out which one would enable you really to, well, one doesn't want to be too optimistic, but maybe knock it on the head completely, and there may even be an effective cure.
Yeah. In breast cancer, I mean, we already have the case of testing for tamoxifen sensitivity, and the fact that that's a simple genetic test, and for women whose cancers are tamoxifen sensitive, there's this very effective therapy available.
In summary, the last year has been fantastic for science, some of the achievements not least landing on Mars, Curiosity, the size of a truck, off taking pictures like never before, Higgs bosons, the work in computing, as you say. Is this being generally recognized by the public, do you think, that while all sorts of things, certainly in sport, certainly in banking, and maybe in politics, not doing terribly well, science really is scoring the goals, is it not?
I think it is, and I think it's not just this last year. Among young people, science is cool again. Science was cool after Sputnik a whole generation and a half ago. Maybe is that two generations by now ago. But we're again at a time where there are TV shows, at least in the United States, which hinge on the scientists figuring things out. The profile of the nerdy intellectual, whether male or female, is often the one in these stories who saves the day. The sad part would be if this resurgence of interest in science among young people coincides with an age of austerity where we're not able to give them the career opportunities to let their creativity come into play and make these important new discoveries.
AAAS President William H. Press, who was Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Harvard and is now Professor of Computing and Biology at the University of Texas in Austin.